From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. In tweets this morning, President Trump took direct aim at Christine Blasey Ford, the woman who accuses Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her at a party in high school. The president wrote that if the attack was, quote, as bad as she says, why didn't someone call the FBI 36 years ago? He added that Kavanaugh is a fine man with an impeccable reputation.
And right now, Ford's lawyers are trying to negotiate details about how and when she will testify next week before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. And joining us today, it's Rick Klein, ABC News political director. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
And Enrique Acevedo, Univision News anchor. Hi, Enrique.
Hi.
So there was this prediction in a speech to conservatives this morning from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Let's listen.
You've watched the fight. You've watched the tactics, but here's what I want to tell you. In the very near future, Judge Kavanaugh will be on the United States Supreme Court.
Rick, before that happens, there would have to be a vote in the Judiciary Committee, then a vote in the Senate. But maybe before that happens, there's going to have to be another hearing or two. What's your prediction of what's going to happen here?
That's a bold prediction by Senator McConnell. Clearly, he wants that. I actually think as a political tactic, that might backfire. The rush to move this forward may be exactly what Republicans don't want at this stage, particularly with President Trump beginning to question the veracity of the accuser in this case. This is problematic, and I think it will give credence to the Democratic arguments that no one on the Republican side is really interested in hearing from Christine Blasey Ford, that they want to go through the motions, and why would she step into a situation where so many Republicans have already pronounced themselves having made up their minds on this nomination?
Enrique, what do you think will happen here, and do you think that she will testify and he will testify next week?
It looks like that's going to be the case, Jeremy, if the conditions that have been required are met. But, you know, truth and politics, what a complicated relationship. And we should be more focused, I know this is a political roundtable, but on the truth, on obtaining the closest version to the truth. That's why I think it's important, of course, you know, that hearing in the Judiciary Committee, it's all about optics, perception, about politics, but about getting to the closest version of the truth, because what's at stake here is not just a he or she said case, but I think the credibility of the American judiciary.
Well, contrary to what you're saying there, Enrique, there are some Republicans who are trying to paint the accuser as mistaken or making a flimsy case. On CNN this morning, the White House counselor Kellyanne Conway compared one accusation against Kavanaugh to accusations by multiple women against some of the men who were taken down because of the Me Too movement.
When one woman comes forward, others come forward. That's what's happened in most of these cases. And I know it's not for lack of trying that people are trying to prove the same here and have not.
Christine Blasey Ford told the Washington Post there was zero chance that she was mistakenly identifying Brett Kavanaugh. Rick, is there any middle ground here politically?
I don't see how there is. I think this will come down to the judgment of a few senators and whether they believe Christine Blasey Ford or they believe Judge Kavanaugh. I think whatever Kellyanne Conway says, I think if there was one established episode of a sexual assault in someone's background, that would be a disqualifier for most of the senators. But we're not likely to know that. We're going to have two different sides that may or may not be aired publicly. I think we know some but not all about the episodes. We're not going to have a full FBI investigation. We're not going to hear from other witnesses. And we're not going to have finality on this. It's going to be in a gray area. And there's one thing I know about politics these days is that it does not do gray areas well or efficiently.
Enrique, Hawaii Democrat Senator Mazie Hirono is being called a rising star in this. It seems like in these controversies, someone always kind of rises to the surface and gets more notice than they otherwise might have. She has made some very strong statements this week. Let's listen to one of them.
Guess who's perpetuating all of these kinds of actions? It's the men in this country. And I just want to say to the men in this country, just shut up and step up. Do the right thing for a change.
What does that kind of voice mean in an argument like this? Does it have an impact or is it just considered politics as usual, Enrique?
Well, first of all, I think it's very good advice for the men in this country. And second of all, we are in the Me Too era, and that plays an important role in everything that's been going on in the last few weeks. I was listening to Kellyanne Conway last night and again this morning talk about how the consequences of alleged sexual assault in, for example, the media industry have taken down some very prominent figures. It doesn't seem to be the case in politics. You know, you can run for governor You can run for the Senate in Alabama. You can brag about groping women and still be president. So I think this is the message that we're sending middle school and high school kids, and it's not the right message. It's not the right example.
Rick, we spoke earlier this week when these allegations first came out with Alice Stewart, Republican strategist who's on our show from time to time, and she said she wants Kavanaugh to be on the Supreme Court, but she said that if it turns out that he lied about this, that that would be disqualifying for him. If we have testimony, public testimony from Blasey Ford and from Kavanaugh, isn't it going to just be about who people in the public and these senators believe more?
Yes. This is not going to be a final version that involves a prosecution or a conviction in a court of law. This is going to be how the Senate deals with these things, which really hasn't changed much since 1991 with Anita Hill, which was a similar he said, she said situation. Mm-hmm. Senators make that judgment. It will come down to a political judgment, which, again, the political system just isn't equipped for that. And I think this has been a test of Washington and the Me Too movement, and I don't think Washington's passing that test.
And, okay. And Jeremy, I think we also have to think about what happens afterwards. Like in 1991, we had a wave of women, that year of the women in 1992 after the Anita Hill hearings. So will this pave the way for, you know, what's going to happen in the midterms and in 2020?
Good segue, Enrique, because let's talk about the midterms. This is President Trump in Nevada last night, stumping for Dean Heller, who's running for the Senate there, Republican. This is a state that Trump lost 2 years ago.
We have to get out for the midterms. Promise me, you got to get out for the midterms. Don't be complacent. You got to get out for the midterms.
Rick, this is a change in tone from President Trump, who's been talking about the red wave that's coming now. I guess Republican leaders in Washington are saying to him, don't make people complacent by saying there's going to be a red wave.
There's a danger if Republican voters believe what the president has said over the last couple of months, which is that don't worry about this, we got this, is going to be a red wave. Well, you got to vote. That's not fake news. And I think President Trump has changed that tone. And I think even in the context of the Kavanaugh nomination, what was once seen as a big motivating issue for Republicans could be a motivating issue for Democrats, the way it dovetails with the messaging that we're seeing in campaign after campaign about the importance of women's voices being heard.
What about going to Texas? Republican Senator Ted Cruz and Democratic Party rising star Beto O'Rourke have their first debate tonight. Enrique, why do you think that Ted Cruz is struggling?
Well, I think Beto O'Rourke has done an incredible campaign. He has raised money and he has connected with the electorate around a very difficult state for any Democrat. It's not a conventional campaign. And I don't remember a Senate debate creating so much expectation like the one we're expecting tonight, like the one we'll have tonight. So, we'll see. But it's getting really close. And I think Republicans are starting to sound the alarm.
And what are the main issues that they're focusing on? I mean, Rick, I assume you've been watching the race very closely as well. What are the linchpins here?
Immigration is obviously huge in Texas. There's been a big back and forth about the way to protest the national anthem with professional athletes, where Beto O'Rourke gave a pretty stirring response on that, and Ted Cruz has been attacking him. A lot of it is the messaging around what it means to be a Republican these days, despite the differences, very publicized differences between President Trump and Ted Cruz. They speak as one now, and we know we're going to see President Trump campaigning with Ted Cruz, Lion Ted himself next to the president next month on the eve of this election.
Who Ted Cruz called a sniveling coward during the campaign.
We started with bold predictions, and I'm going to make one if that's okay. I think the Latino vote in Texas and Nevada, two states we were just talking about, is going to make a huge difference in the midterms and, of course, in 2020 also.
We also saw this week that the stock market hit record highs yet again. The president touted the strong economy last night.
We have the best economy in our history.
Is that, Rick, resonating with most Americans? There are a lot of places in this country where the economy is booming. It's doing really well. There are also a lot of places in this country where, even though President Trump has been saying he's going to take care of the forgotten man, that people aren't recovering the way that, some of the big cities are.
Short answer, no, it's not resonating. And despite the big tax cut, people perceive that as being more of a handout to wealthier Americans, and the fact that people aren't feeling it in the economy as well. You couple that with the distractions of the Trump era, and the Republicans are not getting the credit they believe is due for a strong economy. They still look at that as something that's going to boost their prospects in a couple of weeks in the midterms. But man, they have been singing from that same songbook for a long time, and it just has not been heard.
One final question is, horrific as natural disasters obviously are, they give politicians and presidents a time to either shine in the light or not. Hurricane Florence and a year after Hurricane Maria, what would both of you say very briefly about what President Trump has done?
Well, almost 3,000 people died in Puerto Rico under President Trump's watch. That's an inescapable fact. And I think we should look at the response to that emergency as a national disgrace.
And I think the way that the president disputed those death totals a week ago is something that will linger in a lot of memories. And you see a lot of politicians who otherwise would be aligned with the president just not comfortable with him going there. He seems so intent on protecting his own image, protecting his own agents, his own image in the response that that a lot of the details fell by the wayside. I think that was a shame to see.
Well, it's good to have you both on once again. Rick Klein, ABC News political director, and Enrique Acevedo, Univision news anchor. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Anthony Bourdain became a TV celebrity by traveling the world, indulging in regional cuisine and cooking. Maybe best of all, he'd take a deep dive into different cultures and the people. He used his show Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown to bring attention to the social, political, and economic challenges that people around the world face. Anthony Bourdain took his life in June. He was in France working on the show. His death was a shock. His award-winning program, Parts Unknown, has just won 6 more Emmy Awards this week, and CNN is calling the 12th season the final episodes, and it's premiering this Sunday. Joining us is the longtime executive producer of the show, Sandra Zweig. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How many seasons did you and Anthony work together?
We did the 12 seasons for CNN, but then I was involved with the series prior to this, No Reservations, for 2 seasons.
For 2 seasons, so that's quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
I can only imagine this is a really bittersweet time for you to be airing the final episodes after winning 6 Emmys, but without Anthony. Can you explain how you have enough content for an entire series? How does that work in terms of the shooting schedule and how Anthony was working ahead of time?
Well, I mean, we had shot the majority of the episodes for this season before he passed away. And so there was a large amount of content that was already in the can, as they say. Some of it was in the process of being edited. The first episode, the season premiere, was shot in Kenya with Kamau Bell. And he had already – Tony had written and done voiceover for that entire episode, although, there were some pickup bits of narration that they wanted to get. That show was pretty much completed.
Let's hear some of that. This is the one that's on this coming Sunday. And as you say, he brought along to Kenya the African-American comedian W. Kamau Bell. They went to Nairobi together.
First time on this continent.
Yes.
I'm going to be teasing you relentlessly
that's
about
fine.
This, by the way.
Please, yes. As a African-American, there's a lot of talk about going back to this thing of the motherland.
And a seriously radicalizing experience for African-American comics who've come here before.
Yes.
Life-changing, so we shall see.
We're going to hear some of his excellent writing now.
I will admit to a weird, frankly unlovely sense of been here, done that. It's not a good look for me, I know, but there's a mischievous curiosity tucked away in some poisonous part of my brain that's dying to see how Kamau handles the heat, the spice, the crowds, the overwhelming rush of a whole new world. Because that's what it is first time. This ain't Berkeley.
And that is so Anthony Bourdain. Did he write all his own narration, Sandy?
He did. I mean, the producers and editors would do a scratch, version of the VO so that they would have something to work with as they were editing. But he rewrote everything. I mean, it definitely was his voice.
And you wanted it to be. I mean, you wanted him to rewrite it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But it also, I can't imagine doing the show without his rewrite, if we just handed him a script that he had to read, it wouldn't have had the same feeling. It wouldn't there were just things that he could add. I mean, some of it historical information, quite frankly, that he was like a wealth of knowledge. Mm. And it was part of what made that location interesting or impactful for him.
And that's why it is not only a culinary travelogue, the show, but also over the years became really kind of a cultural touchstone. I mean, it introduced people to different places and people. And then there was the food part. How did that evolve?
Well, I think that was the transition to CNN, I think, was in part because Tony was interested in doing more than what was on the Travel Channel was more of a, you know, travel, food. And Tony really wanted to do more than that. He wanted to go to places that maybe Travel Channel didn't have the appetite for or couldn't help with access to. And that was, you know, the transition to CNN also gave us additional tools and resources and people to talk to about some of those locations that, you know, were on Tony's list but had just never been possible to do.
Here's another example, I think, of that. He and Kamal Bell are talking to members – this is still in Kenya – members of an arts collaborative in Kibera, which is a huge, teeming slum just outside Nairobi.
Many Kenyans are working on a grassroots level to take control of their own future. Kibera Creative Arts being an example. Artists and performers from the neighborhood working to support and develop local talent.
What is it like to be a comedian in Kenya? How does that look?
It's so hard to make people laugh in Kenya. Yeah. You imagine these are people who have not paid
their rent.
Oh, yeah. These are people who have gone without food for some days.
So they come in angry.
Yeah.
Angry and hungry.
Yeah.
So he's talking with members of an arts collaborative there. He also highlighted social and political struggles in the show. Let's hear a little bit of him and Kamal talking to members of the LGBT community in Nairobi.
So how free can you be? Like, are there places in Kenya where you can walk around holding hands with your partner?
You could try, you know. And
are there places you could go where it's not an experiment?
No. I think at all points, it's an experiment.
Well, yeah. So where's the threat from?
Sandy, when Anthony was interviewing people like that, people of very, very different backgrounds in different areas, he's big, larger than life, a big voice. How did people greet him? People from other cultures, what did they make of him?
Well, you know, I think it depended on maybe where he was going and who he was talking to. Tony had a great skill of kind of being the, even though he wasn't any longer sort of an everyman, but still he was very open to listening to other people's, you know, what was going on in other people's lives. And
he didn't have to hold forth all the time?
No. I think he was curious. And he walked into these conversations with a certain amount of information. But the conversation was his. I mean, that was one of the interesting things about if a new, you know, producer or director came on, you gave Tony the information and he had the conversation. It wasn't about kind of feeding him things while you're shooting.
You didn't have to whisper in his ear?
No.
What were the technical challenges then of finishing the season without Anthony?
Well, I mean, we are so used to his voice, you know, and just being able to fill in the holes, the historical holes, the political holes, to establishing a sense of place, to add, you know, humor, to add a point of view. Those are all things that Tony did with his narration.
Can you think of an example, maybe?
I mean, I can think of a fairly simple, straightforward example. One of the episodes coming up this season is Indonesia. And there's a complicated political history there that is very hard to get across without someone kind of leading the way and parsing it out. And so we had to find other tools to do that. And then also just some of it just had to fall by the wayside.
I wonder for you and for the other people behind the program, if when you produced these final episodes, if there were elements of the videotape that perhaps you would have cut out, maybe for timing purposes or whatever, but this time, because of his absence, took on more importance since his death.
Well, I think that there were maybe some – I know that there are definitely some moments in these shows that might not have been in a show were he still alive, because he made some comments that might have been considered sort of off-camera remarks or something like that. But it added – it just added more of his voice, which is, you know, something that is – we're so used to hearing in his narration.
Can you think of something, Sandy?
Well, in the premiere episode in Kenya, there's a moment where he and W. Kamau Bell are sitting, looking out over this kind of vast horizon. Kamau says that – talks about how this – looking at where he is now in his life and being there, you know, just kind of seeing how far he's come, that's sort of an incredible thing for him. And then Tony talks about what it's like for him to, you know – have this job. And he basically says that, you know, the cameras get turned off when we go out and have a cocktail. And he's like, I pinch myself. Mm.
And that's something that maybe was considered off camera.
Oh, he wouldn't have wanted that in the show.
Mm. You know, one of the things that comes up there is just the idea of how his death surprised so many people, because he seemed so engaged with life and the world. And I wonder, since you had a professional relationship with him, if you saw it that way, how – what you think?
I mean, I was as stunned probably as anybody else. I never would have imagined it. So.
Well, the final season starts this weekend. Aside from Kenya, where else will you and he be taking us?
Indonesia, as I mentioned earlier. Asturias, Spain with Jose Andres, the Lower East Side. And there are a couple of specials that we're doing also.
Well, it's nice to talk to you, and thank you for what you and your team with Anthony have brought for all these years. Sandy Zweig, executive producer of Parts Unknown, the final episodes begin airing this Sunday on CNN. Nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you too.
Libraries don't just lend books anymore. Some of them let people borrow fishing poles, knitting needles, even musical instruments. There's a new pilot program in New York now. It lets people use their library cards to check out a necktie, a briefcase, or a handbag if they're going to, say, a job interview or some other important event. Kimberly Spring is network manager of the Riverside Area Branches for the New York Public Library. Kimberly, why did the library start this kind of lending?
So this program began when a talented young adult librarian, Michelle Lee, from the Riverside Library, saw a real need in her community. She hosted a series of job preparation workshops, and she noticed that a lot of her young participants did not have access to professional supplies or gear, such as neckties, purses, briefcases.
As something that might set you apart a little bit when you go up for an interview. And, you know, there are places like Dress for Success and many other organizations that do this very same thing. So how does it fit into the remit of a library?
Well, Michelle has... she has a large following with the young adults that come to the library. They're directly across the street from the Martin Luther King High School. So she sees these teens on a daily basis, and she established a rapport with them. She just wanted to do something to help the students.
And so most of the people who come to her are young.
Yes, but it's just not limited to young adults. Adults are free to utilize the resources as well. It's free access for everyone.
Now, along with the bags and belts, do people also get fashion advice? Like, does somebody say, no, don't wear this one?
Well, you know, we do have resources that can guide people with their fashion decisions. But what we do like to give them is tips to have a successful interview.
So that comes along with checking out a pair of shoes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kimberly, have you seen any recipient of some of the bags and briefcases?
Yes. Actually, one of the The Young Adult Volunteer actually checked out a purse recently as well, and have gone out on a couple of job interviews. I don't know if they got any positive news back yet, but...
But the library should take all the credit if they get it.
You know, when you look good, you feel good. You feel more confident, you know, when you're going out.
Yeah, so. I think that's definitely true. and people are under obligation to bring them back, just like they bring back a book that they loaned out.
Yes. So any material that's checked out is subjected to a 3-week loan period. And, you know, if the item is, we ask that the participants take care of the items. But if they lose something, you know, we're not going to chase after them. We just want them to continue to utilize the service and utilize the public library.
You mean you chase after people to get a fine on a book, but you're not going to for a belt? It's just not fair.
No, we don't chase people. If you have fines, you're still welcome. Come to the library. We'll please, we don't want you to stay away from the public library. Come on back to us.
Whether you need a bag or a tie or a book. All right. Thank you. Nice to talk to you. Kimberly Spring, Network Manager of the Riverside Area of Branches for the New York Public Library. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
As we continue to follow the news about Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court, a lot of attention has been focused on elite schools like the one Kavanaugh went to, Georgetown Prep. His accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, went to Holton Arms, another elite school. Whether or not the allegations against Kavanaugh are true, are these schools, which cost upwards of $40,000 a year for tuition, creating a culture that leads students to behave inappropriately? Adam Howard is a professor of education at Colby College who studies elite private education. He joins us. Hi, Adam.
Hello. It's great to be here.
And you've written about how when you first started researching elite prep schools over 20 years ago, it was a completely new world for you. What surprised you most?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in poverty in rural Kentucky, and so when I entered that world as a teacher, it was just so unfamiliar with my own kind of educational experiences. And part of what made it so unfamiliar are these kind of, you know, rules and norms and values that really kind of governed or shaped interactions, the overall culture of the school. And so that's really what was, you know, I knew how to be a teacher. I was trained to be a teacher, but, you know, it was just so unfamiliar with the culture of elite schools.
Be more specific. What are you talking about? What was different about it?
Yeah, I mean, so it took me, I'll give an example. When I was during my first year, we were doing this unit about homelessness and why it exists and what we can do about it and all of, you know, the typical things that you do as a teacher. And, you know, after spending weeks on this lesson, my students concluded at the very end that, you know, homeless people were just bad business people. So they had put all those kinds of lessons and that I was trying to teach them and kind of frame it in a very different way. So it had to do with the values that they have been taught and that these schools hold deeply.
That they'd been taught by their parents? Because I guess a lot of the students that are going to these schools are the children of wealthy, maybe powerful parents.
Yes, as well as the schools. I mean, schools play an incredibly important role for elites. I mean, the core function of elite schools is to make and remake elite status. Parents and families contribute to that, but they need to send their kids off to elite schools in order to make sure that they maintain and hopefully even advance their class position.
Do you find a sense of privilege and entitlement among the students at elite schools?
Oh, an incredible amount of privilege and a sense of entitlement. I mean, my own research has looked at this concept of privilege, and often, you know, how we frame privilege is something that has to do just about the advantages that someone has. And what I've discovered is that privilege is a lot more than just about advantages, that it's actually something more intrinsically connected to who a person is, rather than something that individuals have or possess. It's something that reveals who they are and who they have become in a fundamental sense. And so these elite schools, a lot of what they do is the practices and, you know, the hidden curriculum and the official curriculum and the rituals and all of that reinforce privilege as a collective identity.
Is there something that is different about the elite schools in the Washington, D.C. area? And there are so many of them, so many famous ones.
Yeah.
Is there something different about them?
I don't think so. I think elite schools, of course, are distinctive, but they are remarkably similar no matter where you go in the U.S. And part of it is that in order to become an elite school, you have to have not only wealthy parents, but you also have to have powerful parents. And so I do think it's distinctive in one sense that, you know, the kinds of jobs and the kinds of lives that the parents and families of these elite schools in the D.C. area kind of lead. But at the end of the day, they're still powerful and incredibly wealthy.
Georgetown Prep, where Kavanaugh went, and Holton Arms, where Christine Blasey Ford went, those are single gender, but they have a brother-sister school relationship. I think of another one, St. Albans in Washington, and Sidwell Friends is an all-girls school. St. Albans is a boys' school. What have you learned about gender dynamics and masculinity at these schools?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that these schools claim is that, you know, being a single gender, schools are, you know, important for the development of the students, that in an all-boys school, that if there's no girls around, then they are more involved in drama and theater and dance and can express themselves and don't have the worries that are associated with having girls. And I just don't buy it. And there's enough research that's been done to kind of prove quite the opposite, that they are really, because they are all boys, that they just reinforce in a very powerful, these hyper-masculine culture. Part of what elite schools do is teach students that hierarchies are normal and a part of everyday life and a part of everyday interaction.
And what about like something like what we're talking about now with sexual assault? I mean, does this breed that?
Yes. That's what it's unhealthy interactions with others, because when you view every interaction that you have as engaging in hierarchies, then there's always a winner and there's always a loser. And in elite schools, I mean, students are constantly taught to be winners. And so what that means is, you know, the hyper-masculine to express yourself and make sure that everybody knows that you're man enough and that you're, you know, there's no questions about your sexuality and a whole variety of things. And so it's just constantly reinforcing that culture of domination.
So I went to public school through high school, but I have a lot of very good friends who did go to some of these elite schools. And they're good people. Like, they really are good people. So are the people that we hear about, whether or not what's being alleged about Kavanaugh is true, there are certainly others who have come out in recent days and said, yes, I went to a school just like this, and we had incidents like this there as well. Are the schools teaching students how to be good people? And are these just bad apples? Or is there a real problem overall with elite schools?
I think, you know, to answer your question, I think elite schools are places where, you know, there's a lot of goodness to be found. If you look at Georgetown Prep, you know, and you look at what they're trying to accomplish in their mission statement, they use words like courage, compassion, care, concern, and all of that. And I think in one sense, and what I found through my own research, is that these types of values and so forth are being reinforced in many ways. And what they're doing is that, you know, these values kind of promote student success, trust within the community, the importance of service, the value of connecting to the past and the present, et cetera. So there's a lot of goodness that is happening. But those same values, also there's another side. They also encourage, when at all cost, attitudes, unhealthy levels of stress, deception, materialism, competition, you know, and so forth, selfishness and greed. So there's a different side to it. And so one of the things I've looked at is kind of what are the lessons, you know, these more positive, productive lessons that students learn, and then what are these not so positive lessons that actually contradict these more positive ones. And because individuals are individuals, and sometimes certain lessons stick with them. And some students, the more positive ones are the ones that they take away from their educational experience. But for others, it's the non-positive ones that's what they end up learning. And what ends up kind of shaping their sense of self and their understandings of self, others, and the world around them in such a profound way.
That's Adam Howard, who's a professor of education at Colby College, who's done research on elite private education. Adam, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Now, North Carolina. Duke Energy Company says a dam at a plant in North Carolina has been breached and that coal ash may be flowing into the Cape Fear River. Meanwhile, travel around the Carolinas is still a challenge. The North Carolina Department of Public Safety says Interstates 40 and 95 remain closed and flooding could keep them closed into next week. Road conditions are constantly changing, and the state says it's still not safe for residents to return to Wilmington. In South Carolina, officials are watching four rivers and expecting them to crest east of Interstate 95 this weekend into early next week. So a lot of challenges remaining in the region 1 week after Florence. Todd Taylor is in New Bern, North Carolina. He's with us on Skype. He's the assistant manager of U.S. Disaster Relief for Samaritan's Purse, which is a Christian relief group, and he's with a group of volunteers assisting residents in their homes. Todd, what kind of damage have you seen?
So we have all aspects of storm damage here with Hurricane Florence. We have the high winds that took down trees and pulled shingles off of roofs, pulled the tin back and caused major roof leaks. Some of them even where plywood may have been pulled off. We see the tree damage where trees have come down in yards and been uprooted. We've seen some trees on top of houses and just broken limbs and things like that. And then, of course, we've seen the flooding. We've seen the heavy tidal surge flooding with the force of those waves coming in off the ocean, just relentlessly pounding eastern North Carolina for hours and hours and hours. And we're also seeing the inland flooding from all of the rain as it works its way back out to the ocean. Even right now, in Kinston on Highway 70, that's been passable for the last several days. We're just now getting reports that that may be shutting down as a result of the Neuse River Basin getting ready to crest. So, you know, we continue to see this developing situation. You know, we've got the area around Pollocksville and Trenton that, you know, the water's still over 8 foot deep right now in the streets and still coming downstream. So, you know, there's so much still evolving with this storm.
So what are your workers doing now?
We've got teams that are cutting trees, moving that tree debris out to the road. But most of our teams right now are engaged with what we call mucking and gutting. So they're going into these flooded homes, removing the contents, pulling out the soppy wet carpet, removing the hardwood floor, the laminate flooring, tearing out the wallpaper and sheetrock and paneling, the wall coverings of the home. When they get everything out, they go back in and they pull all of the nails and screws that were left, sweep out and vacuum out the house and get it as clean as possible.
How can that be done while this is still unfolding? I mean, when there's still flooding going on.
So in some areas, the waters have completely receded. So with the tidal surge, it pushed in, it stayed for a couple of days, and then it receded. So those areas, the ground's a little soggy, the houses are dried out, and people are ready to start thinking about the next steps of recovery.
And can you actually get that material when you do the mucking and gutting? Can you get that old material out of there?
Yes, ma'am. We're able to take that out to the road, and then you know, the local municipalities work with FEMA and North Carolina Emergency Management to make sure that the contracts are in place for the debris removal contractors or the cities to pick up that debris and haul it away.
So they're up and running, I guess, where they can be. The volunteers themselves, when they're doing that and pulling nails out and pulling up floors, how safe is it?
We have a safety briefing every morning for our volunteers. And our objective with our volunteers is to keep them safe. We assign trained team leaders to each work group that oversees that. We provide all the safety equipment needed, whether it's for running a chainsaw with chaps and helmets, to going into a moldy situation with Tyvek suits and masks and gloves. And we want to keep them safe. We work hard to make sure that happens.
Have there been any incidents where somebody hasn't been safe or had an accident?
We've had very few incidents over the last 20 years of volunteers.
You've been doing this yourself how long?
About 14 years.
14 years. You have now returned to the place where you grew up. I don't know if you survived any hurricanes yourself when you were growing up in eastern North Carolina, but what's it like to be there with a different hat on now?
We were actually here in New Bern with Hurricane Irene in 2011. Unfortunately, we're going to clean out some of the same houses that flooded in 2011. We're going to clean those out again. It doesn't matter to me where we are, but it is special to be able to be so close to home, to know that tomorrow and Saturday, my mom and my aunt and some of the ladies in my home church will be bringing food over to our volunteers. That's a special blessing for me.
Well, I think a lot of people, not just you, are going to be looking forward to their home cooking, Todd.
Yes, ma'am.
Todd Taylor, who is the assistant manager of U.S. Disaster Relief for Samaritan's Purse. He's in North Carolina, New Bern, North Carolina, volunteering to help in the aftermath of Hurricane Florence. Best of luck. Thank you, Todd.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for having us today.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.